So generally, this what I'm looking at is cognitive approach to the history of science. And there's a broader thing that one can go into, but things I'm not going to talk about today that are part of the interest. First one, something called the science wars between some of the more radical postmodernists and some of the more conservative scientific types. The question of whether science is unique to the Greek and European tradition or whether every culture has some form of science, and I'm sure Leslie would have things to say about this. Difference between science, pseudoscience, and nonsense. And any questions of morality and values. So I'd like to start out with a thought experiment. Just imagine that you're living 50,000 years ago, say, and you have basically no actual knowledge of the world at all other than what it takes to get along. You want to know what's your attitude towards the world, how do you relate to it, what sort of questions do you ask. And when I tried this experiment myself, there was just a big blank with a question mark. And there are the obvious material questions, food, clothing, shelter, reproduction, and so forth. And those handled pretty much by habit. And then there are the existential questions. What are we doing here? What's going on? You know, what should I do? So forth and so on. And the main question, how do we survive in nature? And our basic tool for survival is reasoning. It's defining characteristic. And in Aristotle's definition, it's a little bit sexist, but you could say humans are the rational animal. So that brings up the question of, okay, if reason is the tool for survival, and that's how we've gotten along in the world, what's rationality? And the standard definition that one finds if one looks in different places is it's reasoning in accordance with principles that are based on the rules of logic, probability theory, that kind of stuff. That's been challenged over about the last 40 years, starting probably late 50s and in the 60s. And late 60s, some real interesting work started coming out. And basically what shows up, you know, back in the 50s, the work and decision theory basically assumed human beings are fundamentally rational, i.e., logical, so forth. Mistakes in reasoning come about because people don't have the right information. They have, you know, maybe some kind of emotional problems or things like that. But fundamentally, people are logical. And this turned out not to be the case. Here's an example. You're going to pay $2 for a lottery ticket. There are two tickets, and I'll give you the numbers, and without thinking about it, just feel which one your impulse tells you. Here's the first one. Here's the second one. Nobody's going to say, almost nobody, unless you're trained, both of them have exactly the same chance. The impulse is, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, that doesn't have any chance of winning. Another example, Sally's quiet, introverted, she's careful to obey instructions, she enjoys reading, she was a top student. Which of these three professions do you think she's likely to have chosen? And again, the catch in this question is, you can't really say based on the information that's given. The information that's given could qualify anybody. So you can't really say that much. there's a little kicker in here too because of the name Sally. If you said Jim, you might be much more likely to choose fighter pilot. So another example, this one is quite well known in some of the literature. Linda is 31 years old, single, outspoken, and very bright. Majored in philosophy. As a student, she was deeply concerned with issues of discrimination and social justice and participated in anti-nuclear demonstrations. Then it gives a list of these 8 statements and says rank them in order of their probability. And almost universally, statement number 8 gets ranked significantly ahead of statement number 6. Namely, people say it's much more probable that Linda is a bank teller and is active in the feminist movement than it is that she is just a bank teller. But of course, that's, according to probability theory, just the opposite. It's much less probable that you have 2 things together than just one of them. Another example, something happens, we ask, why does it always happen to me? Why do I always hit the red lights? And so forth. Well, we have to ask, does it always happen or does it just seem that way? Because there's a little bit of frustration or irritation involved, and that tags the incident in memory. Question, if this picture is true, how have we managed to survive? If reasoning is rationality according to the standard definition, and people are not very good at that, apparently, how have we managed to survive? What we have to do is distinguish something that's true to fact versus something that's true to function. A belief doesn't have to be true in order to be functional. We meet a tiger out in the jungle, doesn't matter if we think, oh, there's a hungry carnivore, genus such and such, or think a horrible forest demon. But, you know, the important thing is that we escape. And what the research has showed up, and the initial research in this was done by Amos Tversky and Daniel Kahneman, published, I believe, in 1973, and showed that in terms of decisions in conditions of uncertainty, rather than using logic and probability, people use certain rules of thumb. They call these the decision heuristics and identified 3 of them called representativeness, availability, and anchoring. And each of these heuristics comes with associated illusions. And they're called cognitive illusions in analogy to optical illusions, because with an optical illusion, you know it's an illusion, but you still see it. With one of these cognitive illusions, you can know that it's an illusion, but it still seems like it's the case. You know, it's sort of an intuitive thing, and you have to exercise a little bit of effort to realize that it might not be true. So there have been about, well, since then, 40-some years of study of these heuristics, and most of the study focused on the ways that they lead people into errors when you judge them normatively. So the first one, representativeness. Objects, elements, properties, people, situations, so forth, are identified and categorized on the basis of easily recognizable features. It's stereotyping. For example, I enjoy this example quite a bit. Back in the late 50s and early 60s, there was an LA talk show host named Joe Pyne. And he was noted for making very vicious attacks on his guests. And he interviewed Frank Zappa. This was early 60s. He said, I guess your long hair makes you a girl. Pyne had been in the Korean War and lost a leg. So Zappa replied, I guess your wooden leg makes you a table. And misapplications of representativeness. At the same time, it's valuable. If we can classify something on the basis of 1 or 2 representative characteristics, then we can assign to that person or situation or entity all of the other characteristics associated with whatever category we put it into. That gives us a lot more information. We don't have to waste time thinking about it, trying to analyze it. And again, if you go back to 50,000 years ago, that's very useful. If you see some pattern of lights and shadows out in the trees there, and you classify it as a predator, you can react right away. You don't have to analyze, well, let's see, what does that look like? What's important is that the categorization be relevant and accurate. And a lot of times it's not. And there's people have classified the kinds of errors that can arise. So first one, things that are striking, that stand out, that are vivid, are often chosen as representative even if they're irrelevant. And there's all kinds of experimental data on this. It's a poor way to discover the absence of a relationship. It's an easy way to discover that fire is hot. It's a poor way to discover that there isn't a relationship between two things. It's dangerous when we use it with small sample sizes. If I go out in rural Mississippi, say, I interview 3 10th grade girls and they say, well, I want to get married when I get out of high school and have a family. And if I generalize from that, take that as representative of all high school girls in North America, I'm making a representative mistake. It often leads to assumptions that effects have to be representative of their causes. So for example, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 doesn't seem representative of a random process. So obviously it doesn't have a chance in the lottery. This was John Stuart Mill identified this, the prejudice that the conditions of a phenomena must resemble the phenomena. Some earth-shaking event must have had an earth-shaking cause. It couldn't have had some small little detail that went wrong. And something called the fundamental attribution error. This shows up, an example is, shows up in psychology, where we see a person behaving in a certain way, and we attribute that behavior to their personality, their character, rather than to the situation that they're behaving in. That's called the fundamental attribution error. On the other hand, when we explain our own behavior, we explain it in terms of the situation rather than ourself, our personality. The next heuristic is called availability, and it's that comparison judgments or estimates of frequencies and so forth tend to be made on what's easily available to the mind, generally from memory. Judgments in terms of frequency, probability, causality, if we can easily recall a lot of examples where something has happened, then we'll make a judgment, well, it could happen again very easily. Has a psychological basis. The tendency of the mind to store information so that the things that are likely to be true are easy to form mental images of and to recall. But that can lead to the error of assuming that if something's easy to imagine, it's likely to be true. And again, this heuristic is valuable. If impressions and experiences are stored with equal weight and memory, and they're unbiased, and the ease of recall is proportional to the weight in memory, and there's no other source of information, then availability is valid. It's basically, like in statistics, they say if you have no information at all, assume everything's 50-50, or assume a random distribution. But again, there are a number of sources of error. Vivid information, intense experiences are much more likely to be remembered. Vivid images stay in the mind longer and they evoke widespread associations. They're easy to recall. Prosecutors in murder trials just love to show images of, gory pictures of the victim to influence the jury. There could be hidden biases in memory that pre-select any what's available. Familiarity effects. And prejudices and beliefs can introduce systemic biases, things we just don't want to see. And I saw a very good example of that in back about late 1980s. There was an article interviewing the anthropologist Maria Gimbastis, who was one of the people behind the idea that Neolithic Europe was a matriarchal, very peaceful society. And she said she started out studying Bronze Age Europe and everything, but said there were all those daggers and weapons of destruction, and I didn't like them, so I just don't look at them. The third heuristic is called anchoring. It's basically first impressions. Quickly adopting assumptions, scripts, theories to construct for ourselves a coherent picture or story of the way things are. And then using later evidence to make adjustments to the picture, but fairly minor adjustments, and then not dealing with evidence that may contradict the assumptions that we've made. And if this is unconscious, then we just automatically use them as an interpretive framework. Here's an example, personal and cultural beliefs as anchors. Imagine a small yapping Pekingese dog. You see it as a cute pet, an irritating pest, or dinner. You know, it depends. Here's another example. This was a study carried out in the mid-80s where focus groups were shown episodes of Dallas, and each group discussed the same thing. They all talked about the same general themes, but different groups saw different things. The Arab group saw moral degeneracy, a Russian group saw rotten capitalism. It's only the American group that discussed business relations. So again, cultural anchors. These are very powerful. They provide the basis for assigning meaning to experiences. They give frameworks that we interpret the world with. And so without, you know, an anchor, we don't know what's going on, and that can be very scary. So a couple of quotations I like. It's only when we understand the process through which the symbolic is cognitively constructed that we can understand the coercive power of ritual. And what politicians manipulate is not ideas, but people's dependence on ideas as a means of ordering, explaining, predicting, and controlling their world. And another quote, everything that looks to another is under spell to that. What we look to draws us magically. The entire life of the practical man is a bewitchment. Contemplation alone stands untouched by magic. No man self-gathered falls to a spell. But these unconscious anchors are just there, and they automatically determine how we interpret the world. And again, this is valuable. If we don't have assumptions or standards for comparison, we can't think about things. The important point is to recognize the assumptions and hold them open to change when new evidence arises. Sources of error, there's a confirmation bias involved, holding on to a sufficient theory without testing for necessity. It's a very poor way of making causal inferences, and it doesn't allow inference of lack of causality from non-covariance. It's basically, here's my first impression, A caused B because I saw it once, so I'm going to assume A causes B, even if I never see A and B showing up together again. Leads to a tendency to ignore evidence that contradicts a belief or a theory. And even if we don't ignore it, explaining it away. Or if I do have to change a belief, making a very minor change, and some sort of ad hoc adjustment. So question, why not use better tools? these seem to be built into the structure of the brain. They seem to be what we've got to work with. And if one thinks about how neural networks process information, they seem to be just what would naturally arise. So they're what we're stuck with. So why not use better tools? And here's an example. This is a well-known optical illusion, the Necker cube. You can see this cube is from two different orientations. There are two illusions. There's the bipolar illusion, and there's the illusion of a three-dimensional object. Just the fact that when we look at it, we see this optical illusion, we see the cube from one direction or the other. Does that mean that we shouldn't project three dimensions into our world? No, it's very useful to be able to see a world in three dimensions. And because of that, we have to put up with occasional illusions such as the Necker cube. So the general conjecture when I came across all this stuff about 15 years ago or so was that the fact is that these decision heuristics make it possible to put experience into language. So they make abstract and symbolic thought possible. And if that's the case, we have to go back and look at reason. The word itself, you know, if you look in the dictionary, comes from a Proto-Indo-European word that means fitting together. And logic means collecting or speaking. That's the root word for logic. So you can start and say, well, okay, a logic is a tool of reason providing criteria for collecting impressions into bundles that can be fit together in thought or in speech. And that's a much broader understanding of reason than the standard definition, namely formal logic probability theory. So how do we fit reason with the heuristics? Representativeness. How do we carve nature at the joints? What pieces are to be fit together? Availability. What do we use for comparisons, for estimates of frequency, probability, causality, and so forth? And anchoring. What's the assumed context? What underlying assumptions or axioms do we make that provide meaning? And so what I thought about then was, okay, if that's the case, then let's look at the history of science as a process of developing methods for using these three heuristics as very general thought processes, necessary processes, without falling into the illusions that go along with them. And so I start out looking at the pre-scientific worldview. I'll skip that fairly quickly. And this is very superficial, basically taken from Fraser. And I can say there's a religious view, magical, mystical, and I'll go over that very quickly, because if you look at science, you can say there are three fundamental metaphysical assumptions that have to be made. The first one, that there actually is an order in nature. Second one, that we can comprehend that order. And the third one, that we can communicate our understanding of this with without ambiguity. And so then, if we look at that, we say, okay, how does this relate to these decision heuristics? And a nice quote again from Jacob Bronowski. What we're doing in science is trying to refine our inner language for communication so that we can say more and more that makes sense about nature and describes her lawfully. And this brings us to the question of objectivity. Three roots. Ontological root, what can we assume objectively exists? The cognitive root, what mental structures are involved in our comprehension of the world? And an intersubjective root, what are the conditions for an unambiguous communication? And usually when I've looked in philosophical writings on objectivity, they focus on the intersubjective root and tend to ignore the other two. But I would claim that all three are necessary. So what I wanted to do was to explore the idea that these decision heuristics provide the basis for studying the cognitive root of objectivity. But that we can be objective only to the extent that we notice our sources of bias and avoid illusion. So let's look at the history of science. And if we look historically, it appears that there are three crisis periods. One of them very early on in ancient Greece, the second one in the scientific revolution in the 17th century, and the third beginning in the early 20th century. And each one of these associated with one of the decision heuristics, primarily associated, all three of them being involved, but one primarily. So the first one, call it the crisis of reason. The early pre-Socratic philosophers came up with all kinds of speculative theories about the world. Thales, who's usually given the honorific title of the first scientist, did some very interesting things, predicted a solar eclipse, which probably was based in techniques he learned from the Babylonians, gave the first idea of a formal proof in mathematics. He's best known in science for his theory that everything, there was a single substance that everything was composed of. And that single substance, he said, was water. Then Anaximander, who was a pretty close contemporary of his, came along and said, no, there's a single substance, but I'll call it the Arche, or the limitless, and everything comes out of that and has to return to it. And then Anaximenes, who was about the same age, maybe a little bit younger, said, no, everything is composed of air, and so forth. So came up with these very speculative theories. Empedocles, you know, earth, air, fire, and water, so forth and so on. So this brings up a problem. How do you choose between your theories? You don't have any concept of controlled experiment, so the only way you can choose between theories is basically aesthetically and rationally. You know, you make arguments for them. You know. And the catch was that they didn't have established criteria for what made a valid rational argument. They didn't have a clear way of distinguishing between proper and improper reasoning. Crisis was brought to a head by the sophists, but it was actually initiated by Parmenides, who famously argued about what is. And he said, what is has to be homogeneous, no boundaries, no beginning, no end, no distinctions, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that led to all kinds of problems. The sophists emphasized persuasive rhetoric. Primarily, they were teachers of the children of the Greek elite, and success in Greek society at the time was strongly based on being able to argue well in public assembly. Gorgias was one of the best known of them, and he published a paper where he argued, and that paper, which still exists, by the way, argued nothing exists. Even if it did, nobody could know it. And even if something existed and somebody could know it, they couldn't communicate their knowledge. If you think about those three claims, they're basically the antithesis of the three assumptions you need if you're going to do science. So there was a real crisis going on. And was finally resolved by Aristotle with his laws of formal logic and his conditions for what makes a legitimate philosophical or scientific argument. he set up for him a legitimate argument, if it was going to be scientific, had to be based on syllogistic demonstration. And you got your initial assumptions from first principles that had to be true, or things that were commonly accepted as true. And he abolished, or say, said you cannot use poetic allusion, metaphor, analogy, things like that to present a proof. You can use them for demonstration, you know, to illustrate a point, but they do not provide you with a proof. The proof is only syllogistic. And that gave a way that people could communicate and understand what, you know, what they were talking about and agree on their conclusions. They could go back and, like they say, mathematicians only argue about their definitions. They could argue about their initial assumptions, but once they agreed on initial assumptions, things had to follow syllogistically. And so it seemed to me this is associated with the representative heuristic. Ask what makes a rational argument? How can you make valid, how can you have valid communication? I.e., how can you put things into categories that you can agree on and classify things? Because once you've done that, then you can agree on how they relate. Or at least you can talk about how they relate. And there's a lot of stuff that happened between then and the 17th century. But the second crisis occurred in the 17th century and revolved around the question of what constituted a valid experiment. What criteria do you have for valid inductive inferences? How do you apply mathematics to descriptions of nature? Because one of the things that Aristotle did was to marginalize mathematics. The only use for mathematics was that it provided the idea of a proof, and your proof was syllogistic. But in Aristotelian science, mathematics is basically irrelevant. You're interested in the science of qualities. You know the essential definition of something, so you know its qualitative character. You make your arguments from that. Starting in the 16th century, late 15th and into the 16th century, you got what they variously called Renaissance naturalism or natural magic or so forth, and all this stuff coming out of translations of Greek works that came into northern Italy from about the early 1400s on, because up until then in Europe all they had essentially was Aristotle and commentaries on Aristotle. Then with refugees from Byzantium coming into northern Italy, they started getting all of the humanistic Greek writings, they got all of the Platonic writings, and a variety of other stuff that was misinterpreted. They got these Hermetic writings that were basically from a second or third century Gnostic sect, but they said, oh, these were go back 2,000 years before Christ and were the precursors of both Plato and Christianity, and that gave them a lot of sort of cachet. By the 17th century, this had come around to the questions here. There were investigators all over the place working on resolving this crisis. A lot of important work was done in the Royal Society, particularly Robert Boyle set experimental protocols. How do you verify an experimental result? What constitutes an experiment? You know, what sort of witnesses do you need to have? How do you report your results? So forth and so on. And Newton, who established how you connect mathematics with experimental results. And then over the next couple of centuries, the development of probability theory and statistics, so you can quantify inductive claims. And And out of this came the hypothetical deductive method. Again, it looked to me as if this was mainly associated with the availability heuristic. Namely, if you go out and start collecting empirical data, you got lots of data. And if you take Francis Bacon's approach and just collect data all over the place, how do you know what to choose as being legitimate and what is not legitimate? So, how do you decide from everything that's available what you're going to include in your analysis? So, looking at these, seem you can construct an anatomy for a crisis, and this is shows up in a variety of ways. It's even gone around sometimes on the internet in a sort of a humorous thing, you know, in the way people respond to new ideas. You know, they first say, well, it's nonsense. Then they say, well, maybe on the fringe they like it. And then they say, well, it could be okay. And then finally, it's, oh, everybody knows that. You know, so first thing, a new method for discovering knowledge about the world. On one side, it's attacked as invalid. On the other side, it's abused. After some time, they come up with limits on the method, and these are encoded in validity criteria. And analysis of the validity criteria leads to a new form of logic. That is, in the general sense, a way of collecting things into bundles that can be put together in thought structures. So with Aristotle, we had formal logic and syllogism, 17th century induction and probabilistic reasoning. So looking at the present day, it seems to me, and this is the fuzzier part of things, seems that today the issue is strongly related to this anchoring heuristic. Are scientific theories just stories that are no better than myth? What are the validity criteria to judge one scientific theory or to say one theory is to be preferred to another? Is it possible for the mind to actually grasp the nature of the world, or are we just stuck with stories? And this all relates to work going on in cognitive science today. So it seems to me that that's the present issue as it goes on. And how does the mind construct its internal images? How are we justified in assuming that these images actually relate to something that exists in the world? And how do we really communicate our understanding of them? So some aspects. What are the validity criteria for computer simulations? There was an article that was published in a journal called Complexity, oh, maybe 6 or 7 years ago now, possibly more, looking at this question. And their final conclusion was, well, there aren't any other than expert opinion. What's the relation of quantum to classical reality? If people are using quantum mechanics as an analogy for just about anything, well, what are we really talking about? What sort of understanding is obtained from purely abstract formal theories? There is a very nice book called Quantum Philosophy by a man named Roland Omnes, who argues that in fact formal theories allow us to go beyond the limits that were proposed by Hume and Kant on human cognition, because they give us more insight into the world even if they don't allow us to form mental images of the world. How can the experiential aspects of the human sciences be treated in an objective way? And every couple of years when I go down to the Florida Science of Consciousness conference in Tucson, that's one of the issues. How do you deal with first-person reports from a third-person perspective? Right there. How do you deal with first-person reports of experience? What's the nature of mind? And so basically the general idea is science is still evolving, and an error that showed up in the late 19th century and persists to some extent today is the idea that the science we have now is it, and anything else, you know, just doesn't make it. And no, you have to look at it and say science is still evolving, and it's, you know, and what I would claim is that right now it's in a crisis period. If you're doing physics, chemistry, you know, the hard sciences, that's not noticeable because they're well established, they have their methods and everything. But if you look at science more generally, if you talk about social sciences or human sciences, then there are all these issues that are still around that are not resolved. So when Aristotle came up with a resolution for the first crisis in science, he left open the question of how you came up with the starting points for deductive arguments. You know, he just said, well, that's, you know, first principles or what everybody agrees upon. Question came up again during the Scientific Revolution with the question of, okay, we can get our principles for our arguments by going out and actually doing experiments. In Aristotelian science, experimentation isn't really legitimate, because what you're interested in if you're an Aristotelian is the natural way things are. And when you do an experiment, you're interfering with nature, so you're automatically producing an artificial result that can't tell you about the natural way things are. So this question of, you know, finding your beginning for your science from empirical data and experimental data was something that had to be thrashed out, and it was done in the 16th and 17th century. That leaves, however, another question unresolved. How does a particular conceptual framework or set of assumptions influence the perceptions that we use to make our inductions? How do we know we're seeing the right things to make our inductive inferences? When we generate a theory, how do we know that that's the kind of theory we want? Maybe we need to have complementary frameworks, you know, look at things from different perspectives. And all of that, you know, is still going on, I would claim, today. So I think I managed to get through this quite quickly. You know, the last time I gave this, it went on for another 30 minutes or so. Yes, that's it.
Well, thanks very much, Bert. Does anyone have comments, questions, reflections, et cetera? First, we'll start with the people in the room here, and then maybe Subhash can show us the board in case somebody off-site wants to ask a question. Are we all sitting here in stunned silence or what?
Just your last slide, well, there's a couple of things, but your last slide, when you talk about complementary perspectives, and as you're talking about, you know, communication, you know, I think of the multidisciplinary kinds of zeitgeist, I guess, that's going on. And does that contribute to the illusions, do you think, or is that going, is this going to be part of the resolution to this crisis you see science in at this point?
It could contribute to the resolution, and it also contributes to the problem. It depends on how it's carried out. And again, I think it's more the way that people approach the discussions. If the discussions are approached with some kind, you know, certain unconscious anchors, then that's going to produce a bias. And the question is to try and reduce that to the extent possible. So I don't know if that answers the question. Yeah.
Anyone else?
Great. Yeah, I've always looked at scientific progress in terms of pragmatic criterion, that is evaluating science on the basis of how effective it is in the prediction and control of nature. Can you comment on that? And has that been a historically, for as far as you see it, has that been an important practical consideration? At one point in your discussion, you implied that, but didn't invoke the notion of pragmatism directly.
The idea of the pragmatic idea of science is, control of nature showed up in the 17th century with Francis Bacon. The Aristotelian view of science was that science was for contemplation. It was for individual contemplation of the world, to sort of build your understanding of the world and give you, the pleasure of contemplating. So, again, this is something new that came in only a few hundred years ago now. Certainly, you could say pragmatically in terms of control of nature, that it's been extremely successful. There's some interesting reading I did relating to this. I'm trying to remember the name, Valentinius. Can't remember the name, but there was a writer who, much to his surprise, he wrote a book called The Chemical Wedding of Christian Rosencrantz, or something like that. And much to his surprise, this became a sort of the literature of the Rosicrucians. What he was interested in was using science to develop a humanistic world and emphasizing not only the control of nature and the use of science, but also the building better people. And in the sources that I was reading, this was contrasted with Francis Bacon, who basically emphasized just the control of nature. And so this is one of the things now in terms of the human sciences is if we abstract and look at, if I'm doing social science and I abstract and I look at things from an external point of view, then I can develop methods of control. But I may not develop methods for improving the internal quality. So what I would say is that in terms of controlling nature, we're doing great. In terms of making use of that control in appropriate ways, maybe we need to look at things.
I'm not really good expert in that story, but historically, you mentioned about the crisis. Kind of surprisingly, the social and natural sciences, they have approximately at the same time, they meet some crisis. Even this ancient time, you mentioned Aristotle time, and at the end of 19th century, the revolutions in society and in sciences, let's say quantum, in quantum physics and quantum theory development, this all happened approximately at the same time. And you mentioned about the current crisis of humanity, and again in social sciences and physics and in chemistry and etc. Don't you think they all have some kind of some test is given to humanity from the higher level.
Well, I don't know about that. One thing that's interesting is going back and reading the history of Athens from about 450 BC to about 350 BC, and it seems very parallel to some of the things going on in the world today. They had the pre-Socratic theories of the world that had come in. These were being used in a lot of ways, much like, say, New Age people today try to use quantum mechanics and relativity. You had an extreme conservative reaction because, especially with a lot of the sophists arguing based on what were considered scientific theories of the world at the time, that, well, of course, you know, the Olympian gods don't really exist. They're not there. They were just creations of our own imagination and so forth. And to that, you got an extreme conservative reaction that ran some of the people out of town and so forth and so on. And very similar in a small single city type of scale to things going on, you know, nationally today. I found that very fascinating. But in terms of, you know, tests provided by higher powers, I wouldn't want to make any comments. Okay. I'll read. Gary's question: can we claim to have a real science today, or are we under a similar set of illusions as science has been in other centuries, when assumptions are wrong, so that the science is wrong? I think that we have to look at science from a somewhat different perspective, and not say that it's wrong. The idea is that we have to use certain cognitive skills, cognitive facilities that we have in order to think. And the question is, how can we best use them at the given time, given what we have available, to think accurately about the world? And, you know, when we apply it to science, we're trying to come to an understanding of nature. How can we deal with nature? How can we control it? How can we survive in it? So we can't say that, for example, the phlogiston theory was wrong. We can say today that we understand the world better. But at the time, the theory produced a number of results that were quite useful. So it's not a matter of saying, well, the past science was wrong, so we're still, you know, and today we might be operating under similar illusions. We certainly are operating under illusions today. We'd like to find out more about them and be able to deal with them more. But it's not a question that we would say, okay, if we find out that something today we want to change, we wouldn't say, well, that was wrong. We would just say, okay, now we've found something that gives us a better view of the world. I hope that answers the question.
Okay, I'm gonna ask one here from my somewhat heterodox perspective. I gotta get back to the question of anchors. Of course, as a cultural anthropologist, that's a whole lot of what I'm thinking about is the ways that people construct, their conceptual frameworks through which they interpret reality. And one thing that struck me is there's a couple of anchors in science that are quite fundamental to the notions of objectivity. And one of them is the idea that time is an arrow rather than cyclical, for example, which, because you get into some quite different notions of the possibilities of cause and effect if time isn't an arrow or isn't always an arrow. I guess that's one, and I guess I'm intrigued by the ideas that, how would I say that, I mean, that our theories of mind or whatever, I mean, a lot of people have holistic perspectives where they see humans and as not distinct from nature, but in partnership with it, and imagine a sort of reciprocal and very interactive dynamic relationship between people and other entities in the world. So I just wanted to sort of ask how those perspectives from non-Western societies might react upon your ideas of illusions and science.
People want to know who is speaking here.
Oh, sorry, this was Leslie Johnson speaking just now.
Yeah, well, this is one of the issues. You know, it's there's a section in the scientific reasoning course that talks about the Evans-Pritchard work with the Azande and the question of whether their view of the world is scientific or not. And one of the textbooks says, well, yeah, this is sort of a proto-scientific approach. And I would say no, it's a different approach. It works, has worked at least, I don't know what the situation is today, but in the time that the work was reported, it worked for the people there. And this goes back to the distinction I made between something that was factually true and something that was functionally true. Now, this time as an arrow is certainly something that's very strongly viewed in science. Well, in particular in physics, where you actually draw arrows. And one of the problems that needs to be dealt with is the taking over of assumptions and cognitive structures from physics in the 19th century and taking them over much more widely in other areas of science and saying this is the way science ought to be done. Basically imitation of success. You find there's Ernst Mayr, who's a well-known biologist, made a comment that along those lines, he found a lot of people, when they talk about science, they think of physics and they think of the way of thinking in physics. And he pointed out that in biology, you have a very different way of thinking, that you think not in terms of arrows and the motion of particles and things like that. You think in terms of populations and structures defined over populations. So it's a matter of saying, okay, when is the idea of cyclical time valuable in terms of giving us an accurate view of the world, and when is it valuable to take time as an arrow? And what was your other comment?
So I was sort of commenting about sort of theories of mind that would sort of see awareness and perhaps even moral agency inherent in everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. And and this is the same thing. Is there one of the books that I came across was called "Is Science Neurotic?" And the author set up what he called a metaphysical hierarchy with different levels At the bottom level, you had things that were, just basically specialized sciences and things that were, very immediate and practical. And at the top level, you had extremely vague assumptions. And it's a question of looking and saying, okay, because the culture we live in has been so strongly influenced by 19th century science, we have to be able to bracket that and look at other possibilities, because otherwise we're working with blinders. There's a quote that again, I can't remember who made it at the moment. I have it written down somewhere, but it was basically that in the 1930s and 1940s, philosophers finally started getting around to taking 19th century physics as the paradigm for science, just as 19th century physics was being shown to not be the way we're going to do physics in the future. It's a matter of being able to bracket the perspectives that we've gotten from our culture so that we can consider other views and not necessarily the mythology that goes with those views, but the way of looking at the world that's behind that mythology. You know, in other words, if you want to talk about, say, a view where you see moral and ethical value in the material world, you might have that in that particular view encoded in some mythology. And it would be a mistake to look at that and say, well, we know that's a primitive mythology that isn't really the way things are because we know better. And that makes it easy to dismiss, but you might say, no, well, what's actually behind that in terms of the way of being in the world?
I notice we have one question on the board, but I'll make a quick comment. I was just thinking as you were saying that about how Aristotle disallowed poetry, and that is in fact one of the issues in trying to communicate the truths as a lot of other cultures see them, because they may have a richer and more symbolic and in that poetic sense way of communicating about their truths.
I'll speak to that and then I'll answer Gary's question. The catch there is if I'm going to communicate something to you poetically, then there has to be some sort of attunement between us as individuals. If I want to communicate something to you mathematically, I just write down the equations and I hand them to you and I don't care who you are. You know, that's the difference. Let's see, Gary's question, can I claim there is a functional use to my claiming that quantum physics, the idea or theory of multiple dimensions, is useful to my understanding of this world? Sure, why not? if it works for you, sure.
Can I just see if I can frame a question here? In working with adult students, many of whom were not in a university setting but in other settings, I found many of them thinking very much in certain concrete terms. And when they do go beyond concrete terms, they often use metaphors, and the metaphors are very practical and concrete in themselves. So the difficulty of getting to think in a more abstract way has always been, it seemed to me, was always a struggle. One of the things I liked about Athabaskan when I got there was the notion of the critical thinking course. My concern now with the critical thinking course has been, you know, the distinction between critical thinking and critical thought. I'm not sure that students come out of that course understanding those kind of differences. But now I'm beginning to wonder whether we shouldn't have a second course questioning the critical thinking course written by Burke, or whether we should ban such a course. Can I just ask a kind of question about when you've done the sort of scientific reasoning course with your students at the undergraduate level, what kind of responses do you get to this kind of argument?
First I'll say the course was set up, the idea in it was that, okay, students, when I was going through university, I got all of my sort of how do you actually do this stuff by osmosis from my professors. And I thought that, you know, at a distance education university, osmosis is difficult. So the course was set up with the idea that students would get most of the things like statistical analysis, hypothesis testing, things like that, in specialized courses, and that what was required was a course that focused more on the softer things like what's the value of a thought experiment, how do you do thought experiments, how do you, you know, what attitudes do you take towards the subject matter and things like that. So that was sort of the focus in the course. The response I get from students, I'd say probably three quarters of the students go through the course. They do moderately well to reasonably well and don't give much in the way of feedback. I get some students who seem to really enjoy it and who say that you know, there's one aspect of the course or another that they find particularly useful. One of the texts that's included is a short book called Prisons We Choose to Live Inside by Doris Lessing. And it's not directly relevant to the course, except that I wanted it there because I think it provokes students to start thinking about, you know, distinctions that have to be made and, you know, what's going on here. So I can't say, you know, how successful I think it is. I think it's reasonably successful. But, you know, and I've also had at least four or five Christian fundamentalists in the course who've written essays in favor of creationism, and only one of them failed. And he actually failed because his first essay he did reasonably well on. You know, it was just religion and science can get along together. His second essay argued in favor of creationism, was basically a rant, and barely I gave him a 50% on it. He failed both exams with about 20% in the midterm and 15% in the final. And, it, you know, I got the impression that all he wanted was to be able to write this essay and pass the course so he could say, look, this view is supported by the professor in my scientific reasoning course. But, you know, so, and it's sort of fun that you get people who come in like that and they're willing to write these essays, you know, supporting things that they know they might get in trouble on. I won't volunteer to do another critical thinking course.
Just for Wayne's information, the original question was asked by Bruce Spencer, to which Bert just responded. Is there another question? Can you identify yourself?
My name is Arzu. I just, if it's possible, I would like to comment on the question of Gary. I remember that sentence someone said, that Newton's brought the light to the understanding of the world and Einstein brought the darkness. It looks like after that we had to understand the world better, but every, you know, the fundamental discovery, it just shows kind of brings more and more misunderstanding. Before we had the theory of atom and very good model, and we could kind of understand and explain everything using that simple model. And now we know that that model is not very, very perfect, and actually it cannot explain lots of things. And then physicists found those quarks and et cetera, et cetera. And after each of those type of the discoveries, we just understand that we cannot understand anything perfectly.
The one that gets me is however many curled up dimensions. I can't even figure out what a curled up dimension is. My brain just doesn't go there.
Yeah. Well, one thing in terms of this is nobody at NASA uses general relativity to plot spacecraft orbits. They use Newtonian mechanics. You know, and actually there have been arguments that science is coming to an end just because it's getting so complex that nobody can understand it anymore.
May I comment on that? My name is Julie Peshka. The notion of time as an arrow is not necessarily firmly embedded in physics, I don't believe, because the Einstein model of relativity took into account the fourth dimension being time, but locally we considered in a Euclidean space where all your axes are straight. But in fact, this is only local. Globally, we can certainly consider it as being curved. And so therefore, it's not excluded that time is cyclical, but there is curvature, it comes back on itself. But locally, we discuss it and we analyze it in terms of straight line arrows in Euclidean space, because that is the fundamental mathematical model we understand most clearly. But I think what he's pointing out is that we're just dealing with levels of complexity. And so, Newton had a certain level of complexity, but his wasn't sufficient in terms of finer measurements. And so then we had to move into a model of relativity. And in fact, Einstein actually supported his model of relativity using finer experiments and finer instrumentation. So I think that we're finding ourselves in a highly complex world. And the more we discover about it, the more complex it becomes, I think.
Let's see. Well, yeah. First, a comment. Actually, Kurt Gödel produced solutions of Einstein's equations that had closed time-like curves, so closed cycles. Let's see, Gary. Historically, we have punished scientists for critical thinking that was seen as sacrilegious. Are we now punishing non-scientists for faith and emotional reasoning? Yes. there are two sides to it, and that's part of this, again, one aspect of this science and morality and the science wars issues that I didn't say anything about, but it's basically on one side we have people making arguments based on faith and emotion and trying to push them into areas that are rightly belong to science. And on the other side, we have people in science trying to eliminate questions of faith and emotion from everything in the world. And, you know, and it's just, again, this idea of anchoring. People anchor on a particular view of things, and then they say, everybody's got to agree with me because that's the way things are.
Which makes co-management of wildlife and resources really interesting. I see and hear a silence around the room and offline. Are we sort of, does anyone else have further questions, comments, discussions, or are we ready to move into sort of wrapping up and getting a last cup of tea or coffee here? Seeing and hearing none, I will take this time to thank Bert very much for a provocative and interesting topic that's led us into some interesting discussion. Thanks so much.